My name is George Cairns, and...
I'm Nancy Cairns.
And this is the second session on deep ecology, and we've labeled this one Worldviews, Perceptions, and Behavior. Just to let you know where we're going is on Thursday, we're planning to look at some new dimensions of science, some of the new science that helps bridge between inside and outside and focuses more on relationships rather than things themselves. It's going beyond Newtonian, kind of Newtonian worldview. Then on Friday, we're going to look at a specific example of eco-action that we were involved with in northern Minnesota that involved Native people as well as ourselves, and kind of has a spiritual core, and look at some of the relationships between the spiritual practices and the action we engaged in, and kind of how we were informed by the grounding coming from different traditions. And then on Saturday, we're going to look at the psychological dynamics that kind of keep us locked in and keep us stuck, and how being in deeper relationship with all of God's creation can be a means to unsticking ourselves from the stuck spots that we're in. This is obviously a personalized view on this topic. It's not meant to be exclusive. What we're doing is sharing with you the things that we found helpful living in the wilderness for a while, and then also living in one of the most damaged ecologies in the world, which is the inner city of Chicago. We'd like to say that we see aspects, we see God's creation, we see aspects of the realm in both places. We see that. I see that on the streets with the homeless people in Chicago. I also see it in places like this. And part of our process here with you this 2 weeks is to help us put some more words in it, because we haven't yet put these things together quite for ourselves. But we come from a praxis kind of model where we engage in certain kinds of action in the world and then reflect on it. And we see spiritual praxis, spiritual process, as well as external action in the world as being mirror images of that. And so I'd like to just give a brief definition of deep ecology that is one that we kind of operate out of, and then Nancy is going to talk about kind of how we got so isolated from nature, some ways that's happened. The way that we talk about deep ecology, at least this week, because this is all in transition, this is all process, is we view it as a path of personal growth and transformation for us as individuals and for systems of human and other biological oppression that works through our full involvement and deeper relationship with all beings. In other words, deep ecology for us means experiencing ourselves as being deeply embedded within the web of all creation rather than standing outside of it. And that once we have, or as we have that experience, then certain understandings encourage us, compel us into action. And for many of us, this requires a metanoia, a real wrenching change of heart. Now, this isn't nicey-nicey kind of experience for us. It's a very profound and difficult kind of experience. And we see this as an ongoing process that requires a continued opening to all of creation. And now Nancy will, I think, begin to show us some of the ways that our culture has cut us off.
Yeah. Again, we see opening the heart as a real key. Letting ourselves take the risk of being in creation rather than being somewhere else, top of creation or outside or superior to. And one of the real difficulties of that is that as a society, as a Western industrialized society with Judeo-Christian roots, we've really closed our hearts to nature. We've arranged our lives and our thinking so that we have very little contact with the richness of the world. And I'm struck with that every time I get into the wilderness. We just took a hike up to 10 Mile Creek Falls, and it's messy up there, you know? I mean, trees fall and they stay there, and there are trees down along that path in all stages of decay, and which is, from our Western point of view, a bad thing. You know, my mother would never allow that to happen, right? Clean that up. But really what that is opportunity for life. You know, decay is the product of living things feeding. And we've set ourselves apart from that. We've done it physically and we've done it in the way we define things. We define nature as not I, not we, something else. We've defined nature as an object, something that we can look at and manipulate and control. And I'm going to talk about a couple of authors who feel that, one in particular, Paul Shepard, who's the author of Nature and Madness, who feels that in doing that, in setting ourselves apart that way, and defining nature, objectifying nature, we've lost a major source of nurturance and a major source of community, of relatedness. And in response to that loss, we have done what human beings do in response to loss. We felt hurt. We felt deprived. And in response to that sense of loss and deprivation and hurt, we've become enraged. And it's the hurt and the rage that then further leads us to close our hearts. Because all this stuff is painful. We don't want to know that we have that loss, that we've suffered it and continue to suffer it. So we've closed our heart to what we can't control. And a lot of what we can't control is our internal pain. And the rest of what we can't control is nature. You know, we can't make it nice and neat and clean and laid out in squares or rectangles with sharp angles. And we've become increasingly insensitive, increasingly more and more insensitive to the richness that's out there. In doing that, we've also narrowed our notion of what is sacred, so that what is sacred has become more and more abstract, and less tied to what's here now all around us. I was struck in the session yesterday with Maria, where we read some very moving and poetic excerpts from myths of primal people, how earthy they are, how connected they are, and how they really celebrate the sacredness of everything. But we've put walls around God so that God can't be earthy and messy and rich and moist and all those things that creation is. Another thing that we've done, and this, there are many authors today who are talking about that, but one of them is Rion Eisler. Another one, there's another book that is in the bookstore that I meant to put up there and forgot, called Reweaving the World, edited by Diamond and Orenstein. Another thing we've done is that we've equated nature with feminine. And we've cut ourselves off from the feminine. So we're closed not only to what we've objectified, but to part of our own self. That we all have, men and women, both. We've closed ourselves off from the soft, gentle, womanly, nurturing, creative, gentle side of our own selves. And today I'd like to talk about the historical and the cultural roots of that, as seen mostly by Paul Shepard and Rion Eisler. Any questions so far?
Yes. You said that we put walls around God, and I would beg to differ with that. I believe we have put walls around ourselves to cut ourselves off from God and cut ourselves off from nature. God is still out there, intermingled, commingled wonderfully with nature.
That's a
It's we who are hurt by that, not
yeah. Yeah, all right. Although I...
Well, God's hurt by that too, but I mean...
Yeah. God has compassion to us for having done that for ourselves.
The birds,
yeah.
The deer.
Yeah.
And we're cut off from that. We did that to ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. In the same way that we've made all these square buildings, some of which in Chicago are tens of stories high, that we can be in, so we don't have to be affected by all that
good stuff.
Out there. Yeah, all that good stuff. Yeah, I agree. That's a better way to say it. Okay. Shepherd asks a kind of basic question. Why do we keep destroying our habitat? Why do we persist in trying to kill our mother? Our Mother Earth.
That's easy. Hmm? It's easy because we think we're more important.
Yeah. And why do we think we're more important?
Because we have an egocentric view of ourselves.
And it's not only egocentric, but it's pretty grandiose.
Yes.
And who has, in any normal society, what human individuals have this unrealistic grandiosity about their power and their needs and their position in the universe?
Men?
Some, many.
Teenagers.
Pardon?
Teenagers.
Teenagers. Women, children. Developmentally, though, in all cultures, so far as I know,
developed countries.
Even undeveloped countries. It's normal to have that kind of grandiose self-image and sense of self when you're about 2 years old.
Okay. Right
now. You know? I mean, toddlers think that when they scream, the whole world stops. When they get angry, they can destroy the whole world just through their rage. And shepherds' point of view is that we have organized our society in such a way that we can't raise normal children who get beyond that grandiosity. We have engineered our society in such a way that we all are stuck in that infantile grandiosity to the extent that we think it's normal and healthy. And what's the source of that kind of psychopathology, that sort of societal and individual psychosis? Shepherd traces the genesis of that to changes in our way of living that have taken place over about the last 10,000 years, give or take. And he traces the beginning of the change to the beginning of the transition from a hunter-gatherer society, a hunter-gatherer way of living, to farming. And that transition was followed by a transition to life in the desert, and which had a profound impact on the thinking of the early desert fathers. And that led, in Shepherd's view, pretty directly to changes that occurred that we think of as the Reformation and to the Industrial Age, which we're still struggling to live in or get out of. And the processes operative in these transitions infantilized and simplified nature, and at the same time made it increasingly difficult for humans to become fully mature humans. And now what he and many psychologists today view as fully mature humans are humans who are complex, who have many differentiated aspects of their being, and who are at the same time integrated. So the differentiated, complex parts of us are integrated in a whole. Um, And I thought, we don't have time to go through all these eras and the particular changes that happened in them. We don't have time to go through a lot. But I thought I would just give you briefly Shepherd's view of hunter-gatherer society, some of which still exist today. And one major idea in primal societies is that all of creation works together. Every part is important and every part is interdependent in specific ways that we understand or we can understand. And all of creation exists to serve, including us. We all exist to serve. And he has one sentence that really rang for me, and that was, success is understood to depend on the readiness of the prey or tuber as much as the skill of the forager. If you go out hunting and you're successful because you come back with a deer that you've managed to shoot, your skill in making your bow and arrow and aiming and drawing your bow and releasing the arrow and finding the heart of the deer is only part of it. The other part is that the deer was there and ready. The deer was there to serve. Your success in finding potatoes is only partly your doing. Potato leaves something above the ground that you can recognize, that kind of waves to you and says, here, you know, I can help you. I don't mind doing that.
Can I give a contrast to that?
Sure.
A kind of a contrast to that is a friend of ours who's a Catholic sister living out on the Rosebud Reservation who was looking at her out her back window and at all the stuff growing in the backyard and says, look at all those weeds out there. You know? And all of her Native American friends who were kind of hanging out kind of sort of falling over themselves laughing, saying, well, those aren't weeds. You know, this is used for tea, and we use this sometimes when we have some burns, and we use this, and these are all medicines. You know, it displayed such a different kind of a sense of belonging to that place.
And one of the first big transitions that Shepherd talks about is that in going from hunter-gatherers to farmers, we made a distinction between things that were tame, which are good, and things that are wild, which are not. And we still have that distinction. We still have plants and weeds. That was a good story. I remember that one. I hadn't thought of it. Another example of that, and this is from an NPR interview that I heard part of when I was driving somewhere, and I didn't get the name of the woman who was being interviewed, and I don't know where she was, but she had served in an African country and had lived with primal people and had had a child who grew up to be about 3 while she was there. And she said every day before she went out to work, she would fix lunch for the child when the child was 2-3 years old. And she would come back and she would find the lunch still there. And finally she asked one of the village elders, you know, why aren't you feeding my child? Like, her lunch is always here when I get back. And the elder was hurt and insulted. You know, how can you imagine that we wouldn't feed a child? You know, she eats with us. And the woman said she didn't realize exactly what that meant until later when they were away from the village as a family, camping, and she noticed that when her daughter got hungry, she would just go and pick something and eat it. And all this jungle out there that she had no idea what it was except jungle, her daughter understood in a way to say, this is food. This is good for me. This is ready for me to eat. Another example of what happens in primal societies is that people are deeply in relationship with each other, and parents are deeply in relationship with their children. And not only are they in relationship, but they are in relationship in a way that celebrates life as sacred and celebrates particular events and transitions in life as sacred. So that children have mentors who are always close to them, on whom they can always count, and who provide models for them that help them to understand and interact with the world in a way that celebrates the sacred. And he talks about rites of passage in this context, and that's another thing that we lack for the most part as a Western industrialized society. And I think one of the symptoms of how the degree to which we lack it is the development of youth gangs in cities like Chicago. If you look at what happens in gangs of adolescents, a lot of it is rites of initiation and rites of passage. And kids need that so much that they develop and perpetuate their own when we don't provide it. And they develop and perpetuate their own in ways that are destructive to them and the environment and us. But they're doing it out of a healthy need.
You said this idea of deep ecology in Chicago, and that does seem like contradictions or oxymoron. But what else can you say about, you know, deep ecology in Chicago? That's a fascinating concept.
Well, one of the things that strikes me often, again, is Chicago is messy. And one of the ways Chicago is messy is that it's full of weeds. You know? And a lot of those weeds are edible weeds. Now, I recognize some of them from the fact that they also grew in my garden in Minnesota. And they grow in the most amazing places. You know, vacant lots on the south side of Chicago that you would think, I mean, looking at it from afar, the south side of Chicago in a lot of places looks like a bomb crater. You know, you would think it would be sterile. It's not. Nature is fermenting there, waiting to help us. And every time it can get the least little crack to come through, it does. You know, Malvina Reynolds wrote a song called God Bless the Grass. God bless the grass that grows through the cracks. We roll the concrete over it to try to keep it back. But the concrete gets tired of what it has to do. Forget the next line and the grass grows through, and God bless the grass.
And the other part, the fauna of the city, there are lots of people who are treated like weeds too. And I think that part of what's been good about us being here this week is to help us further integrate this sense of what it's like to be embedded in creation in places where our usual aesthetic sensibilities make it easy for us to do so. And to see how we can still see glimpses of the realm in the most damaged kind of situations where we are too in the city. And so part of this deep ecology, as we define it, this being, seeing ourselves being embedded within the web of God's creation and seeing our belongingness to it, is to see how people who live in the most oppressive kind of conditions imaginable. And again, the people we're with in Chicago are the norm in the world. You know, we're the exception, I'm the exception, that we realize that our being deeply engaged with them and having our hearts open to them is a process of ecological sensibility. It's, I mean, it's like we as beings are part of the ecology in the city. The major systems, because of the concentrations of human beings, have to do with human beings. And so, so it really is. It's a different kind of practice in a way, but another way, at a deeper level, it's the same practice. So I'm in service with my sisters and brothers on the streets of uptown Chicago, and am able to be fully with them, fully present to them, be open to them. It's very much like being in the wildness and being able to see the interrelationship and the interbelongingness of those things that aren't weeds but are really things that help me along my journey, just as my teachers amongst the poor have provided such such wonderful kinds of help to me along the way. So I don't know if that captures what you're thinking about or not. It is a piece that kind of folds itself in and out of these different kinds of ecological niches.
And this idea of all elements of creation being there to serve, we find ourselves being served by the poor people in Chicago. Sometimes in real concrete ways. Always in a spiritual way, but sometimes in very concrete physical ways.
Well, it seems like the more we live in cities, the more dependent we become on things taken out of nature for our benefit, like shoes. You know, I can't get along without shoes, especially out here. And yet that's not natural material. I can go out and play.
Or it's not natural to find it in this form on a human foot.
Yeah. Or gathering food. I couldn't do that. I mean, even farmers who have a plow and a horse then find it and then get a tractor, they don't want to go back to a plow and a horse. Mm-hmm. And then we go to save the forests, and when people, and we say save the forest, don't cut down the trees, but we like our buildings made with wood like this, and we like our newspapers and our paper. And it just seemed like the levels, we go down the street here, we keep pulling more out of nature.
Mm-hmm. And every time we make one of those transitions, like from the horse drawn plow to the tractor drawn plow, we think that we're making life easier for ourselves. But if you really look at what we do all the time, how we spend a 24-hour day compared to how primal people spend their 24-hour days, guess who has more leisure? So in some ways, this question about why do we keep destroying our habitat is a question, why do we keep complicating our lives?
Yeah, is it egocentric?
Yeah.
The people in the mud hut are blessed with not having to pay for a cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
We can help change that.
And I hope that what we're conveying here is not a romantic view of kind of the noble savage. I mean that is a terrible romanticization of real struggles that people have too in dealing with survival issues. But what we're suggesting is that over the last 10,000 years, at least our sense is that we've gone so much the other way. We've gone so much the other way to manipulating all of our world and distancing ourselves from the interpenetration of the web of God's creation, that some kind of counter, we're moving into a new, we're not, there's a wonderful writer named Ken Wilber, who's, I don't know if any of you know his work, but he's written a book called, he's a developmental psychologist looking at spiritual development, and he has what he calls the pre versus trans fallacy. A lot of psychotherapists and psychiatrists regard any kind of profound prayer experience, and really most of religion for that matter, as regression, right? It's like, you can't cope with your life. This is the view of a lot of psychiatry. And it is the common view for profound religious experience, still by the American Psychiatric Association. And it's regarded...
Although there are points of light.
There are points of light, that's right.
Where did I get that expression?
That's right. But so that's the notion of these kind of transpersonal, as beyond the person experience. Is that we're going back to this two-year-old or earlier stage. But what Wilbur says is what we're doing, if we're well integrated human beings, and we start seeing ourselves, opening ourselves to one another and to all of creation, is we're becoming trans-rational, not pre-rational. And that's why there's a book that we brought with us that's probably the closest book about ecology to kind of what we resonate with, that's called Towards a Transpersonal Ecology. It's seeing ourselves, you know, as being part of something much bigger than ourselves. And so that's this kind of moving beyond we're talking about. Moving in, you know, and there's all this kind of other language, but moving into the postmodern and the new paradigms in science, and we'll be talking about some of that as we go along. But it's moving into and capturing, you know, the gifts that primal people still have to offer us that we've attempted to eradicate as much as possible.
Primal people equal mature people, fully differentiated and integrated people.
It seems to me, George, one of the things is that we've also, with the Industrial Revolution, we have lost our natural meditative moments. When you walk the horse and plow, you've got a meditative moment there where you're on a tractor, you don't dare. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me, even the last maybe 5-10 at the most years, it's got even worse. It's, you know, everybody's got their fax machine, you've got your portable phone, so you're, you know, there isn't even the quiet half-hour drive in the car anymore because you've got to have your portable phone in case somebody needs to reach you. You go into a restaurant, I mean, I swear 20% of the tables, there's a phone sitting on now.
Yeah.
Or a beeper.
Yeah.
And what kind of pressure do we feel?
And that kind of pressure that brings, and to say, you know, where do you find that quiet moment to be with self, to be with God, you know, however you want to define that, when you've got to carry your portable phone in your back pocket, wherever you go.
And so that hurt and rage and deprivation that we experience gets even more so. I mean, it continues to cycle and increase. And we get more and more concerned about controlling this and managing our time. And
you get busy enough, you don't feel the rage.
Yeah, yeah.
The anxiety too. I was part of what we do next week is talking about centering prayer, which is a method of opening up kind of prayer. Some of the people that we teach this to have great anxiety to come into silence. I mean, part of our collective difficulties, struggles in living is that we need to fill up all of our time, because if we open ourselves, we stop for a second to see what's going on, it's just too awful. It can be just too awful for us. And the denial that goes on, the denial of so many kinds of oppression that we're embedded in so many different ways, that if we open ourselves to that, I mean, you think about opening your heart. I mean, what happens when you open your heart? Well, sometimes someone stomps on it with their hobnailed boots, right? I mean, and so coming into silence sometimes and going to us, a kind of receptivity is
very scary.
It's very scary. But what I can say, having had my heart tromped on at least 3 or 4 times, is that out of that pain grows other kinds of risk-taking, willingness to take risks, and a deeper kind of connection with all that is, and with God's presence. And I think in a way that's what we're called to do. We talked yesterday, it's like it's a long way to go with that, huh?
Time goes.
We talked about Sharon Walsh's book, The Feminist Ethic of Risk, about how we're called to take risks.
I want to, before we really let you all have a chance to talk, get my 2 cents worth in about Eisler. Because there's another strand in this business of the changes that have occurred over the last 10,000 years or so. And that has to do with what we've done with our masculine and feminine sides. And that's the perspective from which Eisler approaches social change. And she talks about the transition from partnership models of running society to dominator models of running society and of partnership versus domination as the basis for social and political relationships. And her thesis is that early societies, up to about the time of the early Cretan civilization, organized themselves in a way that was essentially cooperative. And it stressed power with rather than power over, power through cooperation rather than power through domination. It revered symbols of generativity, mutuality, caring, and oddly enough, placed both women and men in positions of authority. And Eisler talks about the transition from this kind of way of organizing your community to a dominator model as showing up in the architecture, the art, the practical artifacts, and the religious symbols of particularly the Cretan civilization, which really was in existence during that transition. And she also talks about some primal peoples who continue to live in partnership societies. So it's possible. It's still possible for us today. And I think that she's right. I think we do spend most of our efforts as a society in dominator relationships. And I think we've gone, we not only try to dominate each other and control each other, but we exert that same kind of domination over nature. And again, we cut ourselves off from the feminine relationship-centered, cooperative, nurturing, soft sides of ourselves, which we all have. And when you think about that, you can think about, well, what might we do? How might we get out of this mess? How might we nurture ourselves, a la shepherd? And how might we cooperate with each other instead of trying to manipulate and control each other? And there are some psychologists who are even talking about models for human development and models for mature human development as individuals in relationship, as mature interdependence as opposed to complete autonomy that would support such a society. So I just wanted to throw that out before we stop talking and let you talk. And I do recommend the books. The Chalice and the Blade is her tracing of the historical events. And The Partnership Way, which I haven't read yet, is her and David Loy's sort of blueprint for how to get out of this. It's the how-to manual for instituting partnership means of interacting.
And maybe I'll just say one or two things about this business about deep ecology in the city, about some ways that things people are cut up. A lot of our work involves not only working with street people and people who are one step up from the streets, but also linking out to more affluent and more homogeneous suburban congregations. And I'm constantly amazed that the places where I spend a lot of my life on the streets, other people are afraid even to drive into in their cars. And so here is an example of humankind cutting itself off from other aspects of humankind and the richness of a community by denial of their existence by physical distance. And so, you know, I think, you know, seeing ourselves and seeing humankind as one of many strands of the web of creation helps us to make these transitions. And again, it's more difficult for me to find nurturance for myself oftentimes, you know, when the gang bangers are shooting on the streets and there I am and there's so many other things going on. It's harder to uncover the healthy strands of creation there, but they're there. It's a little bit easier in places like that. That's one of the important things about places like this, I think, for us. But it's also, I think, very unfortunate if we can't, you know, if we can't make those connections into the more damaged places too, because that's where most of us spend our lives. Any thoughts or comments?
I wonder what someone who is from a primal culture now, or from some other time, drop them into our way of life, and then what would they have to say? It is real easy, like you mentioned, to get romantic about it and think, oh, what a wonderful way they must have had, and still do. Myself being a city person after just coming from being back on the farm, I think even driving on the tractor is far more romantic than me sitting in a traffic jam doing it at work. I had a chance to commune, be aware of this nature. So I don't know how cities can fit with deep ecology. I don't know if even going back to the way the primal hunter-gatherers saw the earth and their relationship to it, if that's something that's even possible, if I'm one of the 5 billion people that march around the planet now, compared to 10,000 years ago, there were probably, maybe 25 million on the entire planet.
Yeah. Let me go back to our definition again, okay?
Because
I think it says it's a path of personal growth and transformation for us as individuals and for systems of human and other biological oppression that works through our full involvement in deeper relationship with all beings. The back, you can see, I think, that pattern which connects, and you know, it's not to romanticize primal people, because many of those cultures are under such stress and such encroachment, such destruction. But what I can tell you is the people I know who've been our teachers, who are primal people, I think primarily of Lakota people, who are the people who we're in the closest connection with, the gifts that those people still give to us about the way that they live their lives and about their spirituality. And you have to realize, I think it was until 1978, these folks were proscribed from practicing their religion. It was illegal to do so. People were arrested on the reservations for practicing traditional ways. And here in this few years, here are people who are compassionate enough to say to someone like me, who's been a part of this dominator culture, we're still gonna open our hearts to you. As a fellow human being, as a human being. And I can't tell you how moving that is to see some, you know, people who are living with, you know, 60 or 70% unemployment, incredible infant mortality, terrible chemical dependency issues, and the constant erosion of their culture still being aligned to...
And their own histories of abuse by white people.
Yeah. Because, you know, we can stomp on their hearts. I mean, you know, and that's, you know, and this person's my heart, but this person would say, my heart shakes hands with your heart. And to do that, I mean, to enter back into that relationship after we've been stomping on folks for 500 years, I mean, it's a testament to the power of their spirituality. That they're able to do. I think there's just some responses to yes.
To me, then, the action of Lakotas with you is consistent with what I've read, and it's
such a powerful action of grace that it's very, very mind-boggling. And it causes me to sit here and ponder the validity of my theology and the commonality of the spirituality in the one God. And that grace comes through those people. And grace comes through Christ. And grace comes through many, many different ways. Let us not think that our Christian tradition is the only way or the best way. It is one of many.
I just had a question. It sounds to me like the feeling of what you're saying is that there isn't really a vision about what transformation means. It only means that you move in that direction, almost in an internal way, giving yourself over to that, not like having a vision, well, we're going to get rid of the cities and we're all going to, you know, that the transformation is part of being a part of creation, or giving yourself over to being truly in relationship with creation, is to not know where creation is going. I mean, is that, I mean, kind of your...
Yeah, it's real dicey. I mean, it's...
It's partly to accept the messiness of creation. Another big shift that's taken place in the last 10,000 years is our sense of time. Time used to move in cycles. Now it goes straight off into the heavens or somewhere.
We'll fix that. We'll fix it on Friday. No, but part of it, you're right. I mean, part of Ben Grover emphasizing one side of the polarity, which is that what contemplation is not a method. I mean, it's a way of being, and we don't mean to get there very often. But that's part of what we're committed to in our lives to be about, and it means being constantly destroying our own agendas. Constantly destroying my own agenda. But I also have to live. And so part of what it is to be a human being is to always have agendas. You know, like agendas are like remembering how to walk. One of my favorite cultural heroes, Ram Dass, says even in the throes of intergalactic bliss, you still need to remember your zip code. Right? I mean, part of this is, and part of it, I think, is to look at systemic issues. Because again, we're focusing in on, because of a personalized view, human transformation. But it's very clear from certainly a lot of things that are going on with issues of racism, issues of domination over the last 500 years of European cultural primal peoples on these continents and on, that systemic evil exists too. And part of what the contemplative view has is to be able to start naming the systemic evil as having a palpability to it, just like individuals do. In other words, there's, I don't know if you know the work of Walter Wink or not. Do you even know Walter Wink's work? Well, there's a great steal on the use of on the cheap book table over here, by the way. I forget what the main title is, but the subtitle is Jesus' Third Way. It's about Bible study in South Africa. And Wink is a... Wink's
violence
view,
and nonviolence.
Nonviolence?
Okay. Violence and nonviolence.
It's an incredible book.
I assume we have that one, or you wouldn't have told people it's for sale.
Yeah, it is over there. That's why it's on the remainder table over there. But Wink's view is that organizations and systems can be demonic. Quick first century theology. That's what demonic systems. And he says, and Gregor, Mars Gregorius, Metropolitan Gregor, talks about this. I said, we're Eastern folks, so we can talk about mystical, weird stuff. But we talk about the powers and principalities, folks, and they're every bit as real as you as individuals are. And so part of our work is to try to get our heads around and be engaged in systems of eroding systems of oppression, while not losing this thrust to continue to erode our own agendas. Because for any of you who've done community organizing, you realize there are ways of overtoppling systems of oppression. But oftentimes, if there's not a spiritual core there, new systems come immediately in. And that's what we're trying to figure out. Basically, how to do both, how to be in that dance. And that's a lot about what religion and spirituality are about, too. Is not to forget our history, not to forget our tradition. We have to look over our shoulders. because we're going to get lost if we don't. But also not to have that so constrain us or so blind us that we're not open to new scientific understandings, to new human kind of uncovering, and to further kind of remembrances of marginalized peoples that we rediscover.
Yeah, you all talked last night about the Western European cultural amnesia. Mm-hmm. And how part of how we do what we do is by not knowing what we've done.
And racism is a perfect example of a demonic system. It's beyond individuals. It's something that has an existence in and of itself. It's palpable. People talk about corporate cultures too. For the corporate folks, that's the way to look at it. About corporate culture, it's something that we're complicit in as individuals, but it has a life of its own. And what I'm suggesting is, in some of the new notions of science that look at relationships rather than things themselves, looking at patterns rather than things themselves, which is also a thrust in some of the new theology that some of the contemplatives, most of the Catholic contemplatives, are engaging in. People are looking at the palpability of these kinds of systems and seeing their reality as being as real as what happens inside of this person's skin. Because I think it helps us we're such a personalized, individualized culture. It helps us to begin to see how these other systems have such sway in our lives.
Good question. You're at a point where you feel like, all right, I feel like you, in your heart, you're healed. And you talk about a dysfunctional society. Now, how did you get there, and how do other people get there?
Well, we're all pilgrims, my friend. There are places of grace. There are places of to give you an example of another kind of gift. We talked about the notion of the primal person. But there's a guy I know who comes to our congregation once in a while. And I was walking down the street one day. He says, "Hey, Father George," call me Father George over at Cardinal Power. I said, "Protestant minister, it doesn't matter." So he says, "Father George," he says, "if you want to recycle any aluminum cans, you need to go over here." And he started giving me these detailed instructions on how to find this recycling, but about 10 blocks away. He says, they give you a penny a pound more over there. That was his gift to me. That was the message. The message was, I care about you. We're traveling down the road together, and here's what I have to offer you. So those kind of gifts are they're moments of grace, and they're in the way we talk about ecology. It's an ecology of us as human beings, connecting in very profound ways.
A lot of people are afraid. So afraid, in fear.
Yeah, I'm afraid too. I thought I was going to get killed in the streets a couple of years ago, and my heart shut down real quick. My heart went closed, and I said, "I'm going to get out of here." And later I realized what was going on, and I wish I had stayed. If I would have been a more saintly person or whatever, I might have been able to hang in there a bit more, but I didn't. It's not a should kind of thing. It's a thing that kind of propels you on. It's like you do it, and kind of the more you do it, the easier it gets, or maybe not the easier it gets, but it happens more.
And that's natural, it becomes.
Yeah.
Well, it's this Johannine kind of stuff about hardening or opening the heart. It's every time you harden the heart, it's going to get a little harder, folks. That's a very strong judgment. If you want to use that kind of theology, very strong judgment is. Every time we open our heart, it's easier next time.
Although I don't know that I would say that that we are healed, or that healing is ever finished.
If you truly believe in what you're saying, then none of us are healed until all of us are healed.
Oh yeah.
If you're talking about being a part of creation, creation.
And the more open you are, the more you feel the suffering of creation.
But there seems to be a lot of hardening out there that some it's harder than steel to come from.
Yeah. It's both, it's like everything else. There's always good news and bad news. I mean, the bad news is it's an extraordinarily damaged set of systems that were in there. The good news is that it provides us with challenges that we find more difficult elsewhere. As part of what we're doing in our church now, we're saying suburban congregations, you poor, deprived people. I mean, you're living in these homogeneous communities, and you don't have the richness of kind of connection that we're blessed with here. And some of it's real difficult for us, but you just don't have it. So why don't you come be with us for a while, and we'll help you begin to deal with the challenges that you're going to be facing very shortly, because we're becoming a very multicultural society, and the problems that we're suffering, with the unemployment that we're suffering in the city, people in the burbs are suffering, and there's a lot of pain. And so we're not trying to draw this kind of suburban inner city kind of, you know, where the good guys are the bad guys kind of stuff, or gals, because it's you know, that's not what it's about. It's it, you know, so yeah, it's a real. I mean, it's easier to open the heart, but it's still painful too. I mean, I guess, you know, that's part of me. That's not.
I was going to say, one of the things you talked about triggers that I had a chance to hear Jean Vanier, this friend who very profound man who's working communities with mentally disabled people. And I think one of the most profound things for me that he said is that many people come to our communities to serve the poor. And he talks about the poor as being the devalued in society, which you can fill in almost any group there. He says they end up staying when they realize that they are the poor. And I think for me, part of what you phrase as the opening of the heart is just to be open that the teachers I have, that I never know who that teacher is going to be. You know, I don't know if it's going to be my kids or the guy on the street I run into or someone in the supermarket or someone in my Sunday school class. I mean, that opportunity is just essentially to keep those eyes and ears open to know that somewhere there's going to be a teacher that day and something to learn. And that I agree with you, not to come and say, well, I've got the answers, I've got it down pat, I've got my cellular phone in my pocket, I'm connecting with the world.
I'm blended with the universe. Can I tell one more short story? And it's what reminded me of it was your question, you know, what would a poor person say if we dropped them in the middle of Chicago? A friend of ours, Marika, was talking to a primal person who got dropped in Chicago and who asked the question, what is this thing about privacy? I don't understand privacy. What's the big deal? We want to be with each other. It's good to have kids because they keep you warm at night.
That reminds me, I had a Vietnamese family that I worked with, and I was helping them, they, you know, were trying to find housing for them and find a nicer place for them in our eyes, you know. We took them to this housing, and it was a two-bedroom apartment. You know, they had two kids and two adults in this little bitty room, and we thought, oh, this is awful. And they went, and they looked at it, and they said, they came back, and they said, we don't want it. I said, why not? And he said, it's too big. And it was like to realize that the difference between the cultural, you know, their relationship with each other and how they wanted to live and how completely, you know, and of course, I my first reaction is, what do you mean? it's a good example of that kind
of. Yeah. Well, maybe, let me tell you one other gift in the city that we're connected with. There's a wonderful program called the Marjorie Kova Center for Treatment Survivors of Torture, and there are people from all over the world who are there, and we've had to work there some, and this program is a program to really encourage people who are survivors to go on about their life and to really heal the systems, heal them within the systems that they exist, because torture really destroys community. Everything we're talking about opening the heart, torture does the opposite. It destroys individuals and families and communities and cultures.
And very systematically and purposefully. There's a technology.
And the gift that's coming out of all this pain and all this brokenness is a gift of understanding and doing psychotherapy that I think is going to ultimately really revolutionize the way that many people in North America